But for 18 years, they didn't rebuild the temple. And in 520 BC, which is where we are in Haggai, Haggai and his mate Zechariah got the people started. And the little book of Haggai tells us four things that Haggai said. And we can translate the dates in their calendar into the dates in our calendar, which I've done there. So that week one, in August, Haggai kick-started them. He said, come on, you lot, let's get started on building the meeting place of God and human beings. 7 weeks later, in October, which we looked at last week, he gave them the encouragement to persevere and to keep going, because we thought last week about how hard it is to do that. And then in December, just a couple of weeks on from now, 520 BC, he said two more things, and we're going to look at one this week and one next week. And this week's one begins with a great deal of gloom. Here are my headings, and if you're not frightened by the first heading, jolly well ought to be. The first heading is Infectious Evil, which I've subtitled The Doctrines of Original Sin and Total Depravity. Isn't that great? Hey, on the edges of your seats, thinking this is going to be a great evening sermon, isn't it? Here we go. Haggai begins with a question. Verse 12. And we think, I imagine as Chris read it, we thought it was a really odd question. But if you've been brought up as a priest in the Old Testament, in the temple, in the first temple, and you were training to be a priest in the second temple perhaps, this was a key stage one question. Kids in reception would know the answer to this question. That the temple was, in some ways, a gigantic visual aid of the distinction between God who is holy and we who are not. So certain things in the ritual were clean, ritually clean, and other things were unclean or defiled. It's nothing to do with what they were physically, it's what they represented in terms of the distinction between God and human beings. So verse 12, look at the question, ask the priests what the law says, that is the law of Moses. If a person carries consecrated meat, that is clean, ritually clean meat, perhaps from a sacrifice, in the fold of his garment, like a butcher's apron, because the priests in the Old Testament were pretty much butchers, really. That was their job, a lot of it. And the fold of his garment touches some bread, stew, wine, oil, or other food. Does it, the other stuff, become consecrated? So simple question, is holiness contagious? If something pure touches something dirty, does it pass over its purity to the thing that's dirty? Answer, verse 12, very simple, no. You didn't need a degree in priest studies for that one. Very simple rule, they all knew that. It's in the book of Leviticus. That's the answer. Holy things get dirty when they come into contact with dirty things. Second question, verse 13. Very simple rule, if a priest touches a dead body for any reason, they become ritually unclean. And they had to go through a ceremony to become clean again. That's part of the way the ritual worked. So question, if someone defiled by contact with a dead body touches one of these things, does it become defiled? So the question's now the other way around. Does dirtiness spread in this picture language? We've seen that purity doesn't, but what about dirtiness? Answer, verse 13, yes, it becomes defiled. Very simple, no prizes. For them for getting that right. Why? What's the point of all this? Verse 14, so it is with this people and this nation in my sight, says God, whatever they do and whatever they offer, that is sacrifices, whatever they offer there is defiled. Now, the people have been working on the temple, getting ready to build the temple for a while, and it may be that they've begun to think that the holiness of the work they were doing was beginning to rub off on them and make them clean. They were associated with a holy building. And maybe they did the equivalent of a sort of spiritual name-dropping, of thinking that we can have holiness by association. And we do. A friend of mine, a neighbor in somewhere where I lived before, I invited him. He wasn't a Christian. Said he wasn't, really. I invited him to one of the men's breakfasts we had in the church I belonged to. He agreed to come. And as we walked up to the men's breakfast, he said to me, you do realize my father was a vicar? And what he meant by that was quite clear in the ensuing conversation. He meant, you don't really need to bother me with this Christianity. You'd do better to find somebody else because my father was a vicar. So, of course, it's rubbed off on me and I'm all right. holiness by association. And God says it doesn't work like that. You can have a Christian father or mother or husband or wife or children. It's a great privilege to have Christians in your family. Paul teaches us that in 1 Corinthians 7. What a privilege it is. It means you hear the gospel. You've got someone living for Christ in your family, praying for you. It's a marvelous thing. But we're in cloud cuckoo land if we think that their rightness with God will rub off on us at second hand. Now, I want to develop this principle of infectious evil a little bit deeper so that we can understand just how bad the bad news of the human condition is, and then we'll grasp more deeply, I hope, what the gospel is and how wonderful it is. And I want to talk for a little bit about the doctrines of original sin and total depravity. And although we laugh at these rather fearsome sounding things, actually I think we'll find that they are precisely speaking to us. There is Article 9 of the 39 Articles of the Church of England. The language is old-fashioned, but I want just to talk about it for a moment. Original sin standeth not, in other words, doesn't mean, in the following of Adam. That is to say, it just so happens that Adam disobeyed God, decided to live for himself, and it just so happens that you and I follow his example. But that's not what original sin means. It doesn't mean that it just so happens that we follow his example, but we might happen not to. But it's the fault and corruption of the nature of every man, that is every person, every human being that naturally is engendered of Adam, every human person, whereby man is very far gone from original righteousness and is of his own nature inclined to evil. Now, I've highlighted the word nature there, because the problem is that we think, I'll put that up again in a moment, we think that the model of human nature is something like that line. That is to say, we think we are basically good, but unfortunately we're perfectly ready to admit that we do sometimes have lapses. So yesterday I may have made an unkind remark to my son, the day before I may have sworn at or kicked the dog. We may be prepared to admit to sins of omission. Maybe tomorrow it'll be a thoughtful letter I ought to write, but I don't. We may even admit that it's sins of intention. So a covetous thought or desire or a proud thought. But so long as we restrict ourselves to isolated little lapses, we have what we might call an atomic theory of sin, that sin consists of isolated moral lapses in a basically, naturally, fundamentally good life. This is the model on which most people in our world work. You talk to them about Jesus Christ and you find that their understanding is that human beings are basically good, although they admit that from time to time we do go a little bit haywire. But this teaching of original sin, which comes from this idea in Haggai of it comes from lots of places in the Bible, but it's there in Haggai as well, of infectious evil that touches and spreads through every part of the human race, is very important, because if I make an unkind remark to somebody, it's not that I'm sailing along living a good life and it just so happens for no particular reason that I slip in an unkind remark and then have to say sorry. That unkind remark has a history in the way I've learnt to behave over the years. And it has consequences in the habits that I build in my own life and in the effects of my actions on others. And we can't separate them. I can't separate an isolated action from the rest of who I am. And I can't separate it from who my parents are or their parents or the whole human race. By nature and by nurture, the human race is deeply infected with sin. It's not true to say that I was born innocent and I just happened to follow Adam's example. Some time ago, the police called at the home of a young man suspected of burglary. And his mother and his brother answered the door and said he wasn't at home, but his three-year-old sister, who was there at the door, as they are, blurted out he's hiding in the wardrobe, as indeed he was. He was not best pleased with his little sister for dropping him in it. But the detective constable commented afterwards, this was in the newspapers, this shows that children of that age can only tell the truth because they are so innocent, and that is nice, end of inverted commas. It shows nothing of the sort. It shows, I think, probably that detective constable didn't have children of his own. shows he ought to know the 39 Articles of the Church of England, and better still, his Bible. It's simply not true. That sort of shallow optimism. That's what original sin means, that our disobedience to God has infected the whole of the human race. And total depravity, which people usually just laugh at if they hear about it at all, total depravity makes the point that the human person is infected in every part by evil. That there's no part, there's no faculty, there's no facet of the human person that is innocent and clean in God's sight. Sin has infected my mind so that I can't think straight. I can't think as I ought to think because I'm a sinner. It's not because I'm not intelligent, it's because I'm a sinner. It's infected my motive so I can't want anything with absolute purity. It's infected my goals in life so that I can't direct myself as I ought. It's affected my body, so my bodily appetites go wrong, whether it's laziness or sexual immorality or greed. It's affected my feelings so that I don't feel as I ought to feel. I don't naturally weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice. Actually, I'm quite pleased sometimes when somebody else weeps, especially if I score as a result. I don't always, and I weep a lot about my own failings and my own misfortunes. There's no watertight compartment in the human person, there's no nature reserve of innocence where original righteousness is preserved. That's what total depravity means. It doesn't, of course, mean that every human being is as bad as we could possibly be. That's what people think it means, which is why we laugh at it. Couldn't mean that, otherwise we'd be indistinguishable from demons. Let me just illustrate it. Imagine I've got a cup of water here, clean water, and I drop into it just a couple of drops of concentrated poison. That water is not as poisonous as it could possibly be. It's not as poisonous as concentrated cyanide or arsenic. But every part of it is touched by the poison. That's what total depravity means. Every part of the human person has been spoiled by sin. It's an irony that in our society we have a great and very healthy emphasis on holistic medicine, holistic therapy. We say you can't divide the human person up into a mind and a body and a spirit. You can't compartmentalize the human person. You must treat a person as a whole person, quite right. But the corollary of that, unfortunately and sadly, is that what has spoiled human nature has spoiled every part of human nature. So there's not one of us here who has ever done, said, or thought anything good. Not purely and absolutely good and pleasing to God. I wonder if you realize that. That's how serious sin is. I have never thought, said, or done anything good, purely good. I've done relatively good things, thank God. And I don't always behave like a demon, thank God. But I've never done anything so purely good that it ought to be pleasing to God in an absolute sense. So there's the bad news. Now let's come on to the good news. Let's put the heading back, as the second heading is much more cheerful. And I think against the background of this bad news, we will appreciate just how marvellous the good news is. So there is the bad news. Here are these people building the temple. And Haggai says, or God says to them, evil has spread everywhere. Evil touches everything. Now, look at 15 to 19. 15, 16, 17, I'm going to move fairly quickly over. He reminds them just how miserable their life has been. He said the same before in chapter 1, verses 5 and 6. And then verse 18, from this day on, and he's talking about the day when the foundation of the temple was laid, from this day on, then again at the end of verse 19, I will bless you. And it's an extraordinary reversal, because he says, by nature, everything is spoiled. The human race is deeply touched by sin. And it spoils and it ruins everything. And is there any cure? And the answer is, yes, there is a cure. And the temple foreshadows the cure. So you build the temple, and in foreshadowing, that foreshadows the cure that there's going to be. And the moral processes of decay are somehow going to be put in reverse. I wonder if there's anyone here who's lived in a house that has dry rot. Anyone ever lived in a house with dry rot? Yeah, it's bad news, Andrew, isn't it? I thought we had it in one of our houses. If a surveyor finds dry rot in your house, she'll tell you not to buy it. You take some with a nasty fungus, it goes right through the fabric of a house, and if you don't kill it, it's disastrous. Put some good wood next to some wood with dry rot in, the dry rot spreads, like evil. But wouldn't it be marvellous if you could put some good wood next to the dry rot wood, and the good wood would cure the dry rot wood if the whole thing went into reverse? Wouldn't it be marvellous, morally, if that could happen in the human race? Supposing these moral laws began to work in reverse. Now let's listen carefully to our second reading, which we're going to have now. Dan Wells is going to read that, and then I'm going to say a final word about the gospel before we finish. Dan.
If you've got a church Bible open in front of you, you might want to turn to page 1032. And we're going to read from Luke chapter 5, starting at verse 12 and going through to verse 16. So Luke chapter 5 and starting at verse 12. While Jesus was in one of these towns, a man came along who was covered with leprosy. When he saw Jesus, he fell with his face to the ground and begged him, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said, "be clean." And immediately the leprosy left him. Then Jesus ordered him, "Don't tell anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them." Yet the news about him spread all the more, so that the crowds of people came to hear him and to be healed of their sickness. But Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed.
Thank you, Dan. Is leprosy contagious? Well, the answer is yes, of course it is. Nobody knows exactly what medically leprosy was in those days, but it was a very nasty skin disease. And you didn't go near a leper. They had to live separately. They had to shout, "Unclean, keep well clear from everybody else." Very dangerous disease. And it pictures sin and moral failure, which is so dangerous because it spreads everywhere. No priest, no Pharisee, and no rabbi would go near a leper. But just watch in your mind's eye as we just relive that amazing little incident that Dan read for us. As the man calls out to Jesus in his pain and his loneliness, and Jesus reaches out his hand and touches the man and says, "Be clean." And immediately the leprosy left him. Isn't that the most extraordinarily vivid picture of the gospel? That's what Haggai chapter 2 foreshadows. Here are the processes of decay in the universe being put into reverse. And if the temple conveyed blessing contagiously to the people who came there in faith, how much more the one greater than the temple? And this is the most marvellous picture of the gospel. And the Lord's Supper that we're going to share with one another in a moment is another visible picture of infectious blessing. Because the temple was the place of sacrifice, the place where sin was atoned for and paid for, and guilt could be washed away and sin could be forgiven. And it foreshadowed that the Lord Jesus Christ, who in his own body took the penalty and all the pain and the disastrous consequences of sin in his own person on the cross. That's why he could reach out and touch the leper and say, "Be clean." And I want to say to us that if there are any of us here who have tender consciences, as I know that some of you do, many ways it's a good thing to do. It's much better than to have a hard or seared conscience. But if you have a tender conscience, you will struggle with the effects of sin in your life. Sometimes you will grieve deeply at what kind of person you are and what kind of person I am. Because we'll begin to understand just how damaging that is. And there are times when I think it would be better if I kept my distance from other people. Because in my experience, I know that if I get close to other people, the closer I get to them, the more likely I am to spoil their lives. And sometimes we grieve and we think, it's just so difficult to get close to people. and to live with them in love and trust without ruining it. And this is the effect of sin, and we grieve about it. And we grieve about living in a world that is spoiled by sin. And if we are like that, and we grieve about this, we need to take this message of Jesus touching the leper, and of the temple, as it were, in foreshadowing and in figure, bringing blessing contagiously to other people whose lives were spoiled by sin. We need to take this to heart and to meditate on it and to realize what a wonderful thing it is to be a Christian believer. To have, as it were, the Lord Jesus touching us and saying, be clean. So that from that moment, in the sight of God, we are clean. And from that moment, the process begins in our lives of undoing the effects of sin. So that although in this life we struggle with the effects of sin, and don't we know it, nonetheless, there is something else going on inside us which is reaching to heaven and which is beginning to change us and be at work in us by the power of the Holy Spirit. It's a marvelous thing. And it's worth seeing just how bad original sin is and just how total the extent of depravity in our lives is in order to wonder at the marvel of the gospel.